R22 tout le monde, antenne cadiste.
Bonsoir, bienvenue à la Fondation Cadiste, merci beaucoup d'être venus si nombreux. Je suis ravie et on est ravis d'accueillir Emeka Okereke ce soir pour une présentation de sa pratique qui suivra par une conversation avec Dominique Malaquet et Lionel Manga. Cet événement est l'occasion de délocaliser le séminaire Something You Should Know à Cadiste. Et je laisserai après Dominique présenter plus en détail la thématique de ce cycle d'événements mis en place avec Something You Should Know. Donc je vais prendre quelques minutes pour présenter un petit peu les intervenants. Donc Emeka Okereke est un artiste, un écrivain, un photographe nigérian qui vit aujourd'hui entre Lagos et Berlin, qui est rentré récemment dans la collection de Cadiste, nous en sommes ravis. Et qui est pour nous cet événement une première occasion de collaborer avec lui. Il connaît bien Paris, parce qu'il y a 10 ans, il a obtenu un diplôme des Beaux-Arts de Paris. Et depuis, il a eu l'occasion aussi de fonder un collectif qui s'appelle Invisible Borders, The Trans-African Project, que vous avez peut-être vu récemment dans l'exposition Cosmopolis à Pompidou. Et ce soir, il a axé sa présentation sur la question des violences passives, et je le laisserai détailler. Ensuite, on est ravis d'accueillir Dominique Malaquet, avec qui, Cadiste, on a eu l'occasion de collaborer en 2015 dans le cadre d'un festival de performance qu'elle a mis en place dans différents lieux à Paris qui s'appelait Africa Acts. Et nous, c'était l'occasion d'imaginer une performance avec l'artiste qui était en résidence à l'époque à Cadiste, Emeka Leyongakpa. Donc, Dominique Malaquet est historienne d'art et politiste. Elle interroge les intersections entre violence politique, inégalité économique et élaboration de cultures urbaines à l'ère de la capitalocène. Elle est d'abord enseignante, mais aussi chercheuse au CNRS dans l'Institut des mondes africains. Et elle co-dirige avec Kadiatou Diallo la plateforme curatoriale expérimentale intitulée Spark. Si je dois dire un petit peu son actualité, elle prépare aujourd'hui une exposition sur la scène de Kinshasa. L'exposition s'intitule Kinshasa Chronique, qui aura lieu en fin d'année au Miam à 7 et l'année prochaine à la Cité de l'Architecture et du Patrimoine à Paris. Je les laisserai après détailler si vous voulez indiquer plus de vos projets. Et je suis aussi ravie d'accueillir Lionel Manga, qui est auteur, écrivain, je voulais dire amoureux de la littérature et orfèvre des mots. L'un de ses premiers essais est L'ivresse du papillon, publié en 2008. Et Lionel Manga est important dans la scène du Cameroun pour avoir introduit la musique hip-hop et le premier concert hip-hop au Cameroun. Également important pour des chroniques qu'il a animées à la radio intitulées Chlorophylle, sur où il lançait l'alerte sur une crise écologique globale. Et son actualité est un ouvrage, et plus que ça, parce qu'on en discutait avant, ça sera aussi une spatialisation qui s'intitule L'Atlas des Tiers, un projet de traduction de l'œuvre de Michel Serre avec François Duconseil, si je ne me trompe pas, sur la question de la part manquante de l'histoire. Est-ce que Lionel et Dominique, vous voulez ajouter quelque chose, ou peut-être que je passe avant tout la parole à Dominique pour présenter le séminaire?
Merci beaucoup Sophie, merci à tous d'être là, thank you so much for being here. Ceci est la deuxième séance de Cosmocide, art, violence, 21e siècle, qui est un séminaire dans le séminaire, de Something You Should Know, donc une espèce de petite poupée russe à l'intérieur de la belle poupée russe Something You Should Know. Nous n'allons pas nous attarder sur Cosmocide parce que nous avons beaucoup à entendre avec Emeka. Nous en parlerons après très volontiers one-on-one, mais pour l'instant vraiment toute la parole à Emeka et infinite thanks for being here. Merci à Cadiste et merci à Something You Should Know. Merci à tous pour votre générosité et votre très grande gentillesse. Merci.
Good evening, everyone. So Sophie just gave me up because I was gonna hide that I studied here, so that I won't be asked. But you always do that, we know. So welcome. I will speak in English. It doesn't mean that I don't understand French. It's just that I'm more comfortable with speaking in English and expressing myself in English. First of all, I would like to begin with an act. I'm from Nigeria, and I am Igbo. That's where I come from, the Igbo, it's a tribe or the ethnic group, Igbo. And we usually have something that we do when it has to do with, welcoming someone to your home. There is the breaking of kola nuts. It is a very, very important act of hospitality and communality where I come from. So we have some kola nuts here, and we are going to do exactly that. So, and why for me this is important is because we are here to discuss violence. But I'd rather start from the perspective of hospitality. And of course, as we go on, you understand that I'm going towards how do we regain or come back to the logic of emotion and, of course, and other things that come with it. So I would like to start with this. I might even call it a ritual, but it's not really a ritual. It's an everyday, it's breaking of kola nuts. And usually, how it goes is that. The eldest.
So right now, I think I should be the eldest. Yeah.
Good. So, I mean, there are things we will bypass. So, like, we'll bypass, like, asking everybody their age. and then the eldest, usually the eldest will bless it, and then pass it on to anybody to now break the kola nut. So that's what we're going to do. Can we have the I brought the saucer. I brought the white plate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to help him. So can we have So what's interesting about this act is that there is always, I don't know how you want to do it, but in the Igbo culture there is always an expression that follows. It is almost in every of the blessing. Is he who brings kola nut brings life. So, and it's always part of that of the blessing. So, I just wanted to say that. So, you go ahead, say whatever you think you want to say, and then you pass it on to me, and I'll break it. And then afterwards, Sophie will now go ahead and break these other ones and share as much as possible. You can either eat it or take it home. Whichever one, but really, it's a way of saying fait comme chez vous.
En tout cas, moi, je suis honoré de pouvoir exécuter un geste antique qui vient de loin, mais dans un contexte totalement contemporain, et qui me ramènera à cet atlas des tiers que je suis en train de confectionner avec François Duconseil, parce que Michel Serres, dans toute son œuvre, n'arrête pas de rappeler que le contemporain n'est pas si contemporain que ça et qu'il a des racines qui plongent loin dans l'archaïque. Et donc, tout ce que je pourrais faire n'étant pas véritablement un initié, mais je pense que ici je suis peut-être le plus âgé, c'est d'appeler sur ces noix de cola, sur nous tous, sur vous tous. Chez nous, on dit que tous ceux qui sont bien arrivés jusqu'ici, quel que soit le chemin qu'ils ont pris, qu'ils rentrent chez eux, en reprenant le même chemin ou un autre, et qui retournent chez eux aussi sûrement qu'ils sont arrivés. Voilà, la bénédiction est faite.
Thank you. So I'm going to begin the presentation, and before that, I would just like to say that my hope is that this is going to be a little bit like loose and free, and it's not going to be all uptight, as if because I don't have any paper I'm reading. I might read from a book. So, coming here, what I have done is to basically gather images and some of my writings, specifically poems, that will serve as cues for the things I'm going to be talking about. So I'm going to be passing from one to the other. Sometimes I'm speaking about the image or the poem in question. Other times, it's basically forming a background for the things that I'm saying. I think I was telling Dominique that I think I have a lot, but we'll see how it goes. And first of all, let me say I'm really happy to have Dominique and Lionel, you know, doing this with me. I've known them for a long time, and some of the things I'm going to discuss is already very conversant with that conversation. And so please feel free to interject, and if you think I'm going off and like there's something that you want me to focus on the image or on the poem, that we can talk about it, and then I continue with the presentation as well. Yeah? So that is just to say, please help me.
It's okay, Mika. Yeah.
All right. So the central theme of my work is that of borders, and I've been dealing with this for a long time, specifically since, I would say, since the second decade of 21st century, which is like from 2009-2010, and much of it has happened around the Invisible Borders Trans-African Project, which I'm going to talk about later. Which has to do with movement, borders, you know, and some of the ideas we've expounded is, you know, looking at how or the role of the body as an active thinking entity, as an entity imbued with intuition, memory, history. Not least of all, inscribed violence. So, as an entity, for the negotiation of borders, and you know, as an object of useful agitation, you know, and within that also, we can talk about the body as an archive. So, it is really within that within this that my work is situated. So you will see. You will see the most recurrent subject is the body, and it's always present. But there's also the question of the linearity of time. And later, I started looking at the linearity of time, starting with the decisive moment. The decisive moment was coined by Cartier-Bresson, the French photographer. And for me, I thought that, you know, it is one of those, you know, concepts that came straight out of, you know, the playbook of, Western European thought logic, which is you order, you choose one, and then the rest is negated. So I started thinking about, this whole idea of decisive moment. For each decisive moment, there are countless, myriad indecisive moment that is just stacked inside it. So, photography being a time-based medium itself, I started questioning how can you break, the linearity of time? How can you escape the siege of time? Of course, this now goes around to join, thoughts like, thinking like, Walter Di Mignolo talked about how part of that, coloniality is also the colonization of time, besides, of course, knowledge, culture, and space. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit. So my work has also looked at, very much, breaking this linearity of time. And as a matter of fact, recently I was I was talking to a friend and trying to articulate, the new works I've been doing and how I've been trying to approach this in my personal work, and so that's the email. So I'll read it a little bit, and of course, in this email you see another expression, the poetics of location, that comes in, which I am going to also. I'll talk about later. And here is the work. I don't know if you can see the text. near Anton de Combe Square, not so far from Kensaruwastrat, some men preached a different kind of preaching. They spoke and screamed at a time before time. They spoke and screamed of a time before time. It was a cold morning. People passed by as they spoke, without stopping by. They spoke into the air, a different kind of speaking. Change your ways, they say, to ears a little too late. In a corner, camera in hand, but without making a picture, I searched for understanding. Tell me to what end all your profoundness, where knowledge is but entertainment. In another square, in another town some minutes away, some men preached a different kind of preaching. The market is always open for the day's sales. This time, I made a picture, complicit in the merchandise of appearances. So this is also a way of sort of like questioning also my position with the camera. And this is also something that I'm constantly thinking about. You know, the camera that, you know, over the history of cameras and, you know, as a tool, is an oppressive tool. So where is my, what is my position? I'm constantly asking that question. But again, this now flows into how I also consider this time. This time also comes with the question of, you know, where do we go from here, the future? So for me, here in this image, we see, of course, the clocks, you know, bearing different times. And then you have the rail, and you have this young man who could easily be a proletariat because he's a hawker. Actually, he was selling the clocks. So I just went to him and said, man, you inspire me. So, and then I told him, let's do this. And then we walked, you know. So it was really in situ. It wasn't like I had to plan this. It wasn't like Jeff Wall, kind of, you know, 3 months.
You took advantage of him being around.
Hmm?
You took advantage of him being around.
Yeah, but there was advantage of it. Yeah, but yeah, advantage of him being around. Yeah, but it was happening there. It was the rails. It was like this, you know, receding background. For me, again, this is something that is recurrent in my work. Is while I'm asking questions about the past and the present, I'm also thinking, where do we go from here? And I will come back to that eventually. The same thing is happening in this image as well. A pregnant woman, and of course, there's this triptych of, you know, and this. Again, we see the hawker. So for me, these are also figures or people that, for me, reading someone like Frantz Fanon really inspired that. Because I kept asking myself, how do you, you know, bring in these people, these proletariats, lumping proletariat. I mean, this is obviously a guy who left, you know, the province to come to, you know, the metropolis, and this is how he's getting by. So there is all of that. Yeah. Sometimes I'm not going to just talk about the image, just for you to see. We are also discussing violence, and I think that this image is a very good example of the kind of, you know, like, this is in the context of Nigeria, of course, where we all know, I don't know if you know Nigeria, you know, we are an oil-producing country, and of course, it seems like it's our curse instead of blessing. So, and basically, this image says it all, you know, the violence of that, and we are really under the weight of that every single day. My idea for this presentation is to go into some anecdotes, personal stories of subtle, you know, covert, passive-aggressive violence that I've experienced both, but most importantly, in Europe. Because I think that it's important to talk about that. I think that, you know, well, let me not think too much. Let me keep going. I'll give you some time to read. I hope you can read from there this time around, because these poems I write them while, you know, like sort of like moving through, sometimes traveling, sometimes moving from one city to the other, sometimes visiting a place. So it's really always on the go. And they are all part of a book that is in the making, which is basically writing on the go and reflecting on the things that I see, that I encounter. Images, basically, that I couldn't make as an image maker. So when I write poems, I also am thinking like an image maker as opposed to a photographer. This work I made in a park called Heisenheide in Berlin, and it's one of the two biggest parks in Berlin, where you have sort of like underground deals going on there, mainly by immigrants. But what's interesting, the story I want to tell using this image as a cue, is this story that I picked up from somewhere about, because there's a zoo in a small domestic zoo in Heisenheide. And I picked up a story one day. Someone was talking about one day a sheep was killed. Some people came in apparently and then they stole a sheep, and the sheep was pregnant. And so they found the sheep dead, like sort of like decapitated, but left like that because obviously they found that it was pregnant and then they couldn't continue. So it was a mother sheep. So they left it there for that reason, I guess. So they didn't catch them, but then the next day or some time later, there was another incident of a goat missing. But this time around, some people saw the guy who was sort of like decapitating the goat and then called the police. And and then when the guy was escaping, the police caught him, and they caught him with the leg of the goat in his backpack. And then of course, the person who was telling this story was obviously one of the people taking care of these animals, because these animals are like supposed to be for children coming in the park, and it's like they're really like you can come touch them. So there was a lot of emotion. And the person telling me the story said he looked at him, you know, he was filled with so much emotion. How could somebody do this? How could people, you know, affect or inflict so much violence on something that is so, you know, harmless and all of that? And then, but what's interesting is that at some point the story now went from that to, and then when the police now caught the guy and they realized that he was Romanian. So for me, at that point, so here I was enjoying a really human, emotional story, and all of a sudden it went to being a migrant, a stereotype. And then so that emotional story was just cut short there. And then we now entered into this, it's now a Romanian, which could also mean that if it was a German, it wouldn't have happened. So we're no longer discussing the emotional logic of the Romanian who did that. We don't even know what kind of Romanian he is. He could be a Romanian with a German passport who's lived in Germany all his life. It could be so many things. But yeah, we're not discussing that anymore. We're now talking about Romanians. And so for me, I think that, you know, this way of discussing our differences is actually the violence of in every day. The way we immediately, before we get to the human story. I mean, for me, I was taken, but I was already imagining, you know, the whole, you know, idea of, you know, you know how we say one man's meat is another man's poison? I don't know if you, but we Nigerians, we use that expression a lot in English. But it's true that we don't speak English anymore. We speak our own kind of English. But we usually say one man's meat is another man's poison. So again, we often say that when we want to differentiate differences, when we say what is real to you could be something else for me. But it doesn't mean that it is. We don't use it in terms of, okay, it is bad or good. It is just basically, it's different. So, and for me, this is a clear case of one man's meat being another man's, you know, precious, pet.
But you have a kind of, among the Yoruba, would say, deities. Mm-hmm. There is one with double face. What is his name again?
Elekwa.
Yeah, but we also have it in the Igbo. We have it as Ikenga, the deity of a double face deity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This could be kind of metaphor of that, definitely.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this story is that we are no longer discussing difference in a really human, level, the emotional level, or to understand where, the emotional logic that, that this Romanian is coming with. We are now discussing, the fact that he is an immigrant. And that, for me, was very disturbing. And every time, this is recurrent, every time you go, there's all of these stereotypes that comes in immediately and cuts everything short. And then we're not discussing that anymore. We're now discussing who is an immigrant and who is not. So, I just wanted to say, to give that. And then move on to this work here that was made in Matan during the Invisible Borders road trip from Lagos to Sarajevo. We traveled from Lagos to Sarajevo. I will talk about that later. When we came to Berlin, we were told not to go to Matan because, by the way, Matan, it's like a suburb of Berlin, 20 minutes away from Berlin by train. And it could easily be Saint-Denis. But the difference here is that that's where, you have the neo-Nazis, the skinheads. And as a black person, it's suicidal, death wish to go to Matan because, and of course, all our friends, all our well-meaning friends in Berlin told us, what are you looking for in Matan? We don't even go there. So what you see is that, and then Matan was the former GDR, you understand? So people who live there are those who feel like the promise of Europe
has failed.
Has failed them. And it's dangerous because oftentimes they've burnt, like refugee buildings there, and there's some amount of truth in there. But what's interesting is the void that it creates between Berlin and Matan. And for us, the premise of Invisible Borders is to really enter these spaces, enter this void, and see how we can use, again, our own narrative. So, again, it's an African project, but it doesn't operate. It's not about location. It's not about geography. It's not. It doesn't operate only within Africa. It's really about, this whole question of borders. So for us, it was very interesting to, see how we can insert ourselves in that narrative, in that void that opens up between Berlin and Matan. So getting there, as these benches, we were told from our research that, and asking around, that actually it was the EU that funded, all these benches, putting it out there. So they call it EU benches. So the whole idea is to, and of course they do beyond that. They give money for planting flowers and making the place look, less GDR-ish, and all of that. So the whole idea, and for me also in our culture, the chair is very important. It's a symbol of again, of coming together, of being together, and I guess this is what they were trying to promote here. But we realized that nobody was sitting in the chair. It was most of the time empty. So we thought, okay, let's sit on it and do it this way. But again, what's interesting is that it was really disturbing the everyday image because, it was like we have to come and put this thing. We are all like coming in with our cameras and our tripods and putting it in there, and all these Mazanians are passing by. So, we're really like in the face, kind of, to see what will happen. But eventually, I think that we were not harassed in any way. I think that people were more surprised than, like, what is happening here? It's just like we are just doing some intervention. And this led to us having a conference, in Matan, where 90% of those who attended were from Matan. At some point, it was weird, when we were discussing it. But at the end of the day, it wasn't as bad as we were told. So for us, what was very interesting is to really experience this and to enter and see how, how to, I don't want to say mediate.
May I come in?
Yeah.
I have a kind of same experience in Berlin in 2000. J'étais invité par le Goethe à Berlin à séjourner pendant l'été. Et un peu comme eux, la directrice Andrea Jacob me dit, écoute Lionel, quand tu vas à Berlin là, de grâce, comme tu aimes te balader, te promener, tout ça, etc., ne va surtout pas à Berlin-Est, parce que là-bas, pareil, il y a les néo-nazis. Je lui fais, oui, Andrea, je serai sage, maman, je n'irai pas à Berlin-Est. Tu m'étonnes. Après 2-3 semaines, je me suis dit, oula, j'habitais à Kreuzberg, quartier d'artistes, etc. Donc, pas loin de Warschau-Strasse, qui est en fait le début de la zone de l'Est. Et puis, je me suis dit, non, mais il faut y aller, quoi, quand même, il faut y aller. Puis, un matin, j'y vais avec un épais bouquin. C'était Pierre-André Taguieff, L'effacement de l'avenir. J'avais trouvé aux Galeries Lafayette, comme par enchantement. Dans le métro, j'y vais. Et puis, cette affaire de Invisible Borders, en fait, c'est-à-dire que ça rentre en jeu. Tu ne te rends pas compte à quel moment exactement, du point de vue de la limite, tu sors de Berlin-Ouest, ce qui était Berlin-Ouest, et tu rentres dans cette zone chez les néo-nazis et tout, etc. Donc, j'y vais. Puis, je sors du métro, je crois, à Warschau-Strasse. Et puis, je mets à marcher. Et puis, effectivement, dans les sur les trottoirs autour, dans les bars, ils sont là avec leurs chiens, avec leurs crêtes, tout ça. Et je me dis, je vais m'asseoir quelque part pour boire une bière. Mais je me dis, bon, fais quand même gaffe. Puis j'aperçois, à un moment donné, une voiture de police qui est stationnée. Et je me dis, OK. Eux, ils sont, en mode de surveillance, quoi. Et je me suis dit, peut-être bien que si je m'assois dans un café, dans ce périmètre-là, il ne va pas trop se passer grand-chose pour moi. Quelques semaines avant, ils avaient balancé dans la Spree, la rivière de Berlin, un immigré, enfin un métèque, on va dire. Hein. Donc, je repère un café, on va dire à 100-150 mètres de la voiture de police. Je décide d'y entrer. C'était l'été. Il y en a qui sont sur la terrasse, il y en a qui sont dedans. Une, deux, je grimpe, je rentre. Je vais au comptoir, ils sont tous... Tout d'un coup, grand silence. On parle de violence passive, isn't it? Et de body, et de corps. Grand silence dans le café. Je me mets au comptoir, grand sourire. Je dis, ah, je voudrais bien une bière. Et puis je suis assis dehors. Puis je suis reparti dehors, attendre ma bière. Et j'ai ouvert mon Pierre-André Taguieff. Puis la bière est venue. Il a posé la bière devant moi. Je l'ai bu pendant à peu près trois quarts d'heure, une demi-heure, trois quarts d'heure. Mais ils étaient tous extrêmement étonnés de voir un métèque sur leur territoire, d'avoir traversé cette frontière invisible que je ne suis pas supposé transgresser. Et pour le coup, effectivement, dans ce que raconte Emeka, on est en plein dans ce rapport avec l'espace et le temps, mais qui sont cernés par des limites qui sont complètement invisibles. On en est conscient et on va se priver d'aller dans un endroit quelque part qui aurait certainement un intérêt aussi. Soit on n'en est pas conscient, et puis voilà, on rentre dedans, il peut presque arriver n'importe quoi. J'en étais conscient, mais j'ai quand même pris quelques précautions en me disant, si une voiture de flic pas loin, je suis sûr que là au moins, il ne m'arrivera pas grand-chose.
So, this image, for example, was again made in Berlin, in Neukölln. And today, Neukölln has become, again, for me, that space where there's a possible site for... You know, like intersections and, you know, I would say decolonial options again, because so many things are happening. What's interesting for me in this image, for example, is this, you know, this German hospitality. So what you see here is, you know, on the right, is it the right? I would say left side on my phone. Is somebody who is arranging, obviously putting out the clothes for somebody who wants to take it. But in the carton there, it's marked, please arrange this in order. So there is this, you know, tension between being accepting and, you know, integrating. And this is really a German thing. So they say to you, you're welcome. But hey, we slap you integration course for 6 months. And I didn't know this really happened to me, right? Because I live partly in Germany. So my residency permit had, and it's interesting because the next story, it's almost like a paradox. My residency permit has immediately they slapped and said I will have to do integration course for 6 months, and what that means is like 700 minutes, which means I have to go to class every day from Monday to Saturday or Friday, and I have to do about 6 hours every day, and I have to go to that particular teacher, and that teacher have to sign you. I'm like, okay, the whole idea is for me to come and present for my next, you know, residency permit that I speak for,
German.
So why are you bothering about how I learn it? You know, but there is a course that you have to go to. But eventually, anyway, I got them to cancel it because I had to prove to them that, you know, my work cannot allow that. So I got them to cancel it. But this is to give you a sense of, you know, that German hospitality where it's like, welcome, but then in order. So then in 2010, I was deported by the Germans back to Nigeria. I was traveling from Paris to Berlin, and so I didn't know, because I lived so for a long time with a residency permit in Paris, so I didn't know. So that was my first, you know, Schengen visa after like some 4 years living in Paris. So I didn't know how to read this Schengen visa, you know, like all the 60 days in 60. You understand if you take Schengen visa. You never understand that stuff. But anyway, this lady took my passport. I was like, okay, we'll go to check. She went, she counted the stamp in, stamp out for the... And I thought I still had some days because in the date it was like, okay. But apparently my going in and coming out, I have overstayed 90 days, you know, in 160 days of a visa. So she came back to me and said, but your visa has expired by 8 days. I'm like, no, it's expired by 8 days. And I thought it was a joke. And before I knew it, I ended up at they put me in a place and they took me to the judge. And before I knew it, I was at the deportation camp. And I spent 3 days at the deportation camp. But what's interesting is, I mean, they put me on handcuffs and everything. And I got to the judge and I said, like, the first thing I asked her was like, why am I on handcuffs? They told me it's for my own protection. I'm like, I've not given you the cliche of the angry black man. So why are you putting me in handcuffs? Of course, she ordered them to remove the handcuffs. But anyway, they took me to this place. What was interesting is that people I met there, I met, you know, men, because I think we're in the men's section. I didn't see women. I met men, you know, from different parts of the non-Western world, mostly, you know, the African continent, from Liberia, Morocco, Ivory Coast, Cameroon. And there was this man who was really, you know, like comfortable in this place. You know, he was already knew his way around. They would play tennis and everything. So we got talking. For me, I was like really thinking, my goodness, I can't be here. You know, this is not... But some people were like, oh, okay. I was like, I asked him, he's like, look, I've been traveling in Europe for the past 20 years without papers. And then I'm here. I said, how long have you been here? He says, like, I've been here for 2 weeks. I was like, okay, so what's up? What's happening with your... He says, well, my lawyer is dealing with this. So are you not eager to leave? He said, no. I want to be here. I said, but why? Because I'm tired. I'm tired of moving around. So this now becomes a place of respite for him. Deportation camp. How bad can that be? But then I said to him, but what about if you just say, you know, you want to go back? You know, let them deport you and you go back to your family. You say, go back to what? What am I going to tell them after 20 years? So basically what you have there is somebody who's 20 years is in parentheses, like as if it never happened. And there is no way for him to move away from that. So going back is like discounting all that 20 years because he has to go and explain to the family what he's been doing for the past 20 years. And I think for me that is really, really violent. This whole idea of making somebody illegal. How do you make somebody illegal?
But the violence is also a maker about what families, you know, in Africa are expecting from those who are traveling. Because they expect them usually, you know, to be like, to go back like golden boys or golden girls, you know. This story, you could get so many aspects of, even in my country.
Yeah, but you know, what's interesting is that, let's not discount the fact that what makes, you know, these, you know, people move from where they are is so they can find a better life. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a crime.
No.
They want to find a better life to make, you know, life better for their families back home. So they've not lost sight of what they are traveling for. And for 20 years, he kept looking for that. But he is illegal. And there is a sharp line between being legal and illegal. And there is no soft landing. And that's the violence for me.
Mm.
That's the violence. And again, how do you make legality? You know, Europe likes to talk about how there's corruption in Africa and all of that. But when there's corruption in Europe, it is first drafted into the law and made legal. And then NATO, UN resolution, they can veto it. They can come together and decide to go and bomb somewhere and take away presidents in a resolution that they can veto. So who makes legality and who makes people illegal? And I think that here is, and there's a lot of people, I've met people in Amsterdam, I've met people in Paris, in so many places who 15, 20 years of their life, they are illegal simply because they don't have papers. And yet, they contribute to that economy, but not because whatever they buy, they pay taxes indirectly. So it's not as if they are not contributing. They are working what you call black, but they are illegal. So for me, this is very violent. this is maybe a comic relief. That's me jumping, you know, demonstrative, you know, jumping across the border in 2014 when we were now traveling by road from Lagos to Sarajevo. So I stopped at this border because I was thinking about, you know, 4 years ago when I was refused and deported from the same place. So I was, and of course, sorry, I didn't. And of course, I continue this whole, you know, again, the body and the notion of dispossession. Of course, when we look at this now and then, also think about this Cameroonian who was at the deportation camp and how, you know, this, all of that, you know, made illegal and dispossessed, in a, so to speak, you know, by that illegality. So again, and this work was made in Lagos, obviously. So again, of course, you know, during my stay here in, at Cadiz, I've been also doing some work and doing some writing. So some of the poems that you're seeing are very recent. And of course, in this particular poem here, I come back to the question, where do we go from here? You know, that line you say, s'il vous plaît, la chapelle, is something really that happened to me here, where I was just going down with, I think I was standing with Moshekwa, we were standing together, Moshekwa Lambe, and a man came and said, very, you know, non-existent French, and he just, La Chapelle. And I remembered what I was told here when we were having a conversation, that a lot of them come and then they ask for La Chapelle, not knowing that it's actually a metro stop, but it's a place of respite. It's where some of them have traveled for long, we don't know, but they had a small backpack, we don't know what is inside it. He could have traveled from so many, you know, from maybe Italy or even all the way from Africa, but he's going to La Chapelle, and you know how La Chapelle is. It's like a place they come together and then begin to look for a life from there. So so this poem sort of like, you know, references that. And for me, I'm always returning to this whole question of the Paris under Paris. There's a Paris of the postcards, and there's a Paris of, you know, Jaurès, Stalingrad, La Chapelle, and they've always been there for a long time. Even when I was here studying, there's that Paris. And so for me, in my poems, I'm sort of like also, you know, like putting these two together in a way. So like there's the Paris that we know of postcards, you know, like I remember, you know, like living in Cité des Arts, Pont-Marie, you have those, all those in front, you have all those, you know, even in Montmartre, you have all these people painting in like a really beautiful picture of her. And what's also even sometimes deploring is that people who sell the small Eiffel towers here in Montmartre, and
the souvenirs.
The souvenirs are people who, you know, cannot really subscribe to that idea of Paris. You know, they go back to La Chapelle, they go back to the places where that Paris is not real for them at all. So in my work, in my poems, I'm always trying to set this, you know, two kinds of Paris, or two kinds of Bordeaux, or two kinds of Amsterdam, with each other, against each other. Or. So for me, you know, photographing a place like Barbès and Château Rouge, and for me is, I feel like these are places, like I've said before, and I was saying to Dominique earlier on, that I think that some things that we are discussing in terms of, you know, like post-racial conversation, post-colonial conversation, is already happening there. We were in this, you know, a conference at that time, and a lady was presenting a thesis on racial hospitality. And my question to her is like, but we are 800 meters away from Château d'Eau. How are you having that conversation with this? Because I know that when you go there, the way people deal, the way people, they are constantly coming up with ways that is sort of like breaking away. It's almost, when you look at how things are done, when you look at the economy, it's everywhere. It's like, even in Amsterdam, in Belma, there is an informal taxi, you know, system that is very organized. They're called Snowda. You come out, and it's cheaper to take them than to take the bus sometimes. And when you want to leave around that area, you want to go to parties or anything, your Snowda is ready. You come out, you know it's him, but they're very organized. So there's all this system of that's happening within a place like Amsterdam. Even we make the city of Amsterdam baffle, you know, at how organized they are. And so I see these places that are sites for, a different way of being, you know, breaking away from this coloniality. And then I will come back to that. Coloniality in relation to modernity, which is like the rhetoric of the lies of modernity hiding. Of course, that's Watamiolo, talking about the darker side of Western modernity. But basically talking about how we are all still caught up in that colonial matrix of power. You know, but you go to places like this, you already see solution, things happening. And I'm very much interested in going there and experience, even if it's as a researcher, as someone who's curious, to say, I was there. You know, I might not even make work, but at least I know that I have lived this part of Paris, I have lived this part of Amsterdam, I have lived this part of Bordeaux, so that tomorrow when I'm talking, it's not like, oh, you know, you're talking about just the Eiffel Towers and all the beautiful, this is really real and it's happening. And I draw from that a lot. Talking about home. So in the same light as well, I have, you know, photographed places like this. Like, for example, in Lagos, you know, I live in a place of the same kind called Bariga. And I have also been photographing there. And my recent work there is photographing, you know, Bariga at night, when, you know, one of the biggest problems we have in Nigeria is a lack of electricity. You know, don't even tell me we are supposed to be the giant of Africa, but the South Africans will not. You know. but we're always having this light problem, and for me, really living in a place where it's an issue. So I started photographing at night. You know how people go about, you know, living, and you know, living with, you know, no light, and how they make their own light. And so you see it already, that it comes from, you know, the torch, you know, the powered, you know, powered by battery, oftentimes coming from China. So you see that, so it's a whole series. So I spent, last year I spent some 3 weeks to 1 month in Bordeaux, but before that I have been in Bordeaux 14 years ago. Photographing in Bordeaux. What's interesting about Bordeaux, of course, we know, is the patrimony. But recently has been, you know, named. I think it has been identified as a site, UNESCO World Heritage, and of course, much of that is the patrimony, which is Bordeaux and the docks, the quay, and all of that. But of course, what's interesting about Bordeaux is that it has its history. Like Nantes and Liverpool, it has this history of, you know, slavery and colonial merchandise. So what's in Bordeaux is unique in the sense that, you know, at the same time they have, I think, the highest number of black scholars in the universities. So it's a place where constantly the black community is having that conversation. For example, when I came to Bordeaux, when I came to Bordeaux in 2014, there was at the Musée d'Aquitaine, there was no. We're having discussion about how to represent slavery or that story, that history of Bordeaux in the museums, and there was no space for that at the time. Fast forward to 2009, that eventually happened, and of course it was pushed by some of these people I've been photographing. This is Sheikh So, a poet, a musician, and he is really in front, alongside other people as well, in front of that conversation, pushing and making sure that that happens. Of course, this is Perrine, a dancer, part of that as well. But what is interesting about Bordeaux and the salle now, the salle d'esclavage, that eventually was put up, is that this is the first text you see as you're entering. And so there's this whole, you know, already there's a disclaimer, almost like a disclaimer, saying, oh, we were just part of everything else that was happening in Europe at the time. So that's to relativize the whole thing. It's not as if there's no truth in this.
But,
you know, the fact that you have to relativize, like, oh, well, yeah, we are just being a function of the time. And you will see that as you go through the salle. So what happens is that you go through there and then you see Toussaint Louverture, but it's like a footnote. And then you will see, on the other hand, you will see a reenactment of the middle passage, you know, middle passage of video, you know, people's labor. And then, fast forward, you move immediately into, voila, we are in Renaissance. And that was when we realized that, you know, we have evolved as human beings and it was not okay anymore to deal on slavery. But between that reenactment and, voila, Renaissance, there's a huge chunk of, you know, narrative missing, which is all the everyday resistance by the slaves themselves. A historian told me that, from Haiti, told me that that acts of resistance has followed every act of violence like the shadow follows the sun. That's how he put it. We didn't get any sense of that. We got a sense of, first of all, a city that was a function of this time. In fact, you could see there that it was already saying where they are in the whole, you know, they were lesser than La Rochelle. Oh, yeah? Good. But then, from there, and then moved into, you know, Renaissance. We have evolved. And so, I think that for a young Baudelaire, who is also an African, going into that museum, he's not going to feel like this has anything to do with him. He's not going to take anything from that. He's not going to be empowered. He would rather watch Black Panther.
Ooh. Ooh.
We're coming.
Ooh. Ooh. To begin with, this is where the Atlas de Tier comes inside your story and what I'm doing with the Conseil nowadays. Because this story of slavery, we only know one side of it. There is a big book, a thick book. You saw it yesterday. The title is Half of the Story Have Never Been Told. Il s'agit, je vais le dire en français là maintenant, d'un épais livre qui vient de sortir. Il n'est pas tout neuf, mais il y a moins de 6 ans. Quelques auteurs aux États-Unis ont entrepris d'étudier la seconde saison de l'esclavage aux États-Unis. Celle qui commence à peu près au moment où on parle d'abolition, mais en fait, d'abolition, les propriétaires se mettent à déplacer les esclaves sur l'ensemble des États-Unis. Et ça donne une économie qui produit ce coton, qui va être, comme dit Edward Baptiste, c'est l'auteur de ce bouquin, le carburant de cette deuxième moitié du 19e siècle, qui habille l'Europe. Toute cette partie de l'histoire que le barbu, le grand-père Karl Marx, a eu beaucoup de mal à théoriser, mais sans laquelle, du point de vue de l'économie, il est impossible de penser tout ce qui s'est passé par la suite en Europe, et en l'occurrence, jusqu'à la Renaissance.
Et cette histoire, ou plutôt cette part manquante-là, c'est bien d'elle qu'avec mon ami du conseil, on est en train de s'occuper avec l'Atlas des tiers. Parce qu'il y a beaucoup à remettre en lice pour que nous comprenions où nous en sommes. Comme il dit Emeka depuis le début, where do we start from? Yeah. At that point. Michel Serres, dans un de ses récents livres, il dit que l'histoire est surtout une longue suite d'oublis. C'est une excellente définition de l'histoire. Excellente. Mais excellente, quoi. Et quitte à ce que ça embête tous les historiens, mais il y a effectivement une espèce de... C'est même plus un point aveugle. C'est une saison aveugle dans laquelle il va falloir qu'effectivement nous entrions tous pour pouvoir avoir enfin un récit à peu près complet. Je dis à peu près complet. Mais c'est un travail qui va demander que nous nous y mettions tous de ce point de vue-là et qu'on cesse de penser que les esclaves ont attendu l'abolition. Ils se sont beaucoup barrés pour se tirer de ce sacré mauvais pas-là. Même avant Bois Caïman, qui est connu parce que, bon, c'est la, on va dire, c'est la séquence la plus partagée dans l'histoire, il y a d'autres histoires de résistance. Entre ceux qui, depuis les bateaux, se jetaient à l'eau pour ne pas arriver au bout, entre ceux qui se suicidaient, histoire de dire que, hé, hey, les gars, là, ce que vous fabriquez, là, nous, on n'en participera pas, quoi. Ils n'ont pas attendu l'abolition, hein. Ces corps-là, ils se sont donnés à la mort en disant, nous, en tant que corps, on n'y participera pas. L'Atlas des tiers va, dans quelques temps, parler de tout ça.
Yeah. It's really... So, in the case of Bogdo, it's really like, you know, struggling with how do we tell the story while also keeping all of this as our heritage. Because the truth is, for every building standing in Bogdo, up to the... What's it called? Like the face, the statues, like the faces that you find. What's it called again? You know, they put all these faces of the landlords of the... They all participated in that. So how do you tell the story while laying claim to this as national heritage and build all of, you know, the pride of Bogdo on that without negating, you know, history? And of course, it brings me to this Miwado that we have in Bogdo. It is right in front of Place de la Bourse, and we know what that means. It's a place of exchange. And of course, the Mirado was built exactly at the quay. So basically now it is... So I was talking to one of the thinkers and artists, and he's like, we had our interview there, and he was saying to me, you know, like, Emeka, I feel like this Mirado is like, you know, Bogdo reflecting its own beauty onto itself. Like, you know, mirror, mirror, you know, who is the fairest of them all? You know, this sort of like... But underneath all of that is the fact that it is actually, suppressing a much, you know, larger, much more important history of the place. But you build a mural to reflect this, you know, onto itself. And of course, then there is the tourism. You know, it's one of the most visited, you know, monuments in the world. And so you have all these people also. Then you have also a different kind of merchandise of the body happening there, but that is attached to capitalism. Again, I didn't mention in the beginning of my presentation, I think that what went wrong with the world is when, you know, we put human relationships at the expense of capital. That is the only thing that is wrong with the world. By the time we begin to reclaim human relationship and put it on its place, then we'll move forward. Everything is stuck in that. Race is an excuse for that. Everything is stuck in the fact that if you go to San Francisco, you see that. Mission District, you know, people are being like thrown away. You know, all the six-figure, you know, tech people are coming in to buy everything. And, you know, these people are losing that, you know, their what is it, quartier. You know, to these people who, you know, are coming in with the six figures. So they don't care. You see a lot of people on the street in San Francisco, in a place where there's so much money, you know, so much, you know, wealth, yet people, a lot of homeless people on the street. And we can say the same almost for Paris here, with La Chapelle and everything. So it is, you know, first of all, capital you know, has to now come back secondary again, and human relationship be at the forefront. And yeah, now talking about that, I come to this Fondation Louis Vuitton building here that was just built in a place that was like cutting through a whole expanse of nature. You know, on the side of it is the Jardin d'Acclimatation. You know, and what's interesting is that I'm reading this book here by T.J. Demos called Against the Anthropocene, Visual Culture and Environment Today. But what's interesting is he's coming in from the perspective of visual culture, which is more or less what this foundation and this building is supposed to stand for. But again, I think there was just one sentence there. He just said, perhaps the Anthropocene is now best described as the age of corporate activities. So at the end of the day, the people who are having the most and the loudest argument about climate change, about solving the problem of the world, are the ones who are going to make profit from it. And you see the exhibition that is now taking place there, you get a sense of that, because half of the work is talking about climate change and natural disaster, as if they are trying to buy some conscience or to absolve themselves from that. So I think that places like this we should think of in terms of the everyday violence to our everyday lives, and things like this.
And so far, yesterday morning, I bought the paper Le Monde. There was a huge article in Le Monde saying that we are not just going to get out of the oil era. It is still to be there for long. And there are some figures about transportation of petrol. How do you say petrochemical in English? That's just growing, you know. It's about growth. So oil is still there for a long time. And they say in the paper that we should maybe forget about the COP21 resolutions. Mm-hmm. This is how and where we are getting, into the kind of, what was worth doing the COP21?
This is like a GIF that I made from watching the documentary of the actual Black Panthers. And this was like a part that I found very interesting. And it was talking about, of course, Huey and, Free Huey and all of that. And, of course, you see that it's, for me, it's like this Free Huey is blinking and all that. But again, it's for me to allude to the precariousness of that dream, as just blinking. At the end of the day, we know also, the fate he suffered. At the end of the day, he wasn't really, the person to look up to anymore for that, for that dream of the Black Panthers. He suffered a lot. He went to prison. He came up, but he was so popular, and he carried all of that. And so for me, I think that this, for me, best, represent the precariousness of this whole, fad and everything around the black is beautiful and all of that, and creating movement, of which one of them today is the Black Panther, is that I have written about and talked about again how it is a function of that coloniality, which is, again, I don't want to spend so much time on that, but it is very clear and obvious that the only thing that is coming out of that and beautiful to an extent is that for the first time we are seeing a lot of black bodies, in a mainstream, blockbuster movie, filmed, and the camera was on them for a long, long time. Now that's a big change. For people like us who come from this level, all we watch is Hollywood. That's a huge change. And I think that is, what people are misplacing and thinking there's all of a sudden a revolution. So much that one of the soundtracks is Heron Scott's This Revolution Will Not Be Televised. I thought that was very appalling, really, to even go that far. They could get Kendrick Lamar to do whatever he wants to do, yes. But, to go that far and take... the guy would be rolling in his grave right now, for that. But I think that so many people went to watch that movie, but you need to see this documentary film about the real Black Panthers. You need to see. You need to see what it means to actually sacrifice your life for something. You know, and I think we have to return to that. We have to return to that, like, okay, what are we really doing? This is, how do we, you know, yeah, anyway. So, yeah, I just wanted to touch on that, and immediately, where do we go from here? And here I'll talk about the poetics of location that I began with, moral concept of the impossible, epistemic disobedience, thinking as remembering, thinking as introspection. Poetics of location for me, I think I want to refer to Edward Lisson with poetics of relation. But I think that beyond that, there is also, an extension of that is the poetics of location. That is to say, you know, it is shifting from, you know, the Western hegemony, and it is going to other places. And there are several centers and peripheries, and it is actually tangible. It is not, you know, like the Jean-Jacques Rousseau's of the Renaissance who sit and write romantically about a place. You can actually go there. Invisible Borders is about that. Is you go and you think from where you are. And, of course, I will show you. Then the moral concept of impossible is by John Berger when he was talking about the work of Magritte. You know, I would like to read out what he said about that. Nevertheless, he refused to retreat from the present as it is lived, by way of a cult or either aesthetics or personality. What he had to make as an artist, he made of the present. This is why very many can recognize in Magritte a part of themselves which otherwise has no place in the present. The part which cannot concur with the rest of their lives, which cannot refute the moral concept of the impossible, which is the product of the violence done to the other parts. So, basically, the way I understand this moral concept of the impossible is you hold on to that impossibility. That is how you cross over. That is how you cross or you break away from that colonial force field that we are all still in, to hold on to this moral concept of the impossible. And I think that is, you know, and of course, to push that is to push beyond that boundary of coloniality. And of course, it's Walter Di Mignolo who, in his idea of, you know, talking about epistemic disobedience, the poetics of location, collapse in the distance, that is oftentimes a myth. The distance between Africa and Europe is an artificial distance. I'm not saying that there is not, you know, that we cannot engage it, but oftentimes, for example, the drowning in the ocean, the dying in the desert, but what we forget is that there's an actual road. You don't need a 4x4 to drive from Lagos to Sarajevo. There's an actual road. So the only thing is that there are people who are manning the borders and deciding who comes in and who doesn't come in. So while we are all commodifying or sort of like, you know, like really consuming this narrative of people dying in the sea and the likes of Ai Weiwei making work out of it, you know, we should also understand that it's actually a constructed narrative, that it is sustained, it has become an economy as well. So it's important for us to think about these distances and how they are, you know, they are sometimes artificial and a myth and reinforced by all these whole ideas of borders.
I just want to put one word about that in French. There is a book, il y a un livre qui a été écrit par Peter Sloterdijk, Voyage, Palais de Cristal, Voyage à l'intérieur du capitalisme planétaire, dans lequel il explique effectivement, pour mettre de l'eau à ce que Aimé K a dit, la Terre a été transformée en ensemble de sites, que des sites qui permettent à la marchandise et à l'argent de circuler, mais absolument pas aux corps humains, etc. Et cette manière construite de transformer des lieux géographiques en sites à absorber ce qu'il appelle, et j'adore cette expression, la dignité des distances. C'est-à-dire que les distances en tant que réalité géographique et terrestre ont fini par disparaître complètement du point de vue du capitalisme et n'être plus que des espèces de couloirs. Et en fait, d'un point de vue global, Lagos et Paris, ou Amsterdam et Yaoundé, seraient comme deux chambres dans une même maison avec un couloir qui les sépare, ainsi de suite. Mais ce qui est cette possibilité-là, qu'on puisse passer d'une pièce à une autre, séparée par un couloir juste, en ramenant la terre, une espèce d'énorme maison comme celle-là, c'est ce qu'aujourd'hui, les dispositifs ou les dispositions qui existent ne nous permettent pas, alors que de fait, il y a un certain article 13 de la Charte des droits de l'homme qui dit que chaque être humain a le droit d'aller et de venir où il veut. Mais comment se fait-il qu'on ait laissé les États, nations, on va ajouter, mettre sous cloche l'article 13 de la Charte? Je me demande si l'on fait un vendredi 13, on peut rigoler dessus. Mais l'article 13, comment se fait-il qu'on ait laissé les États-nations mettre sous cloche cet article-là? Alors que de fait, le propre de l'homme, ce n'est pas juste le rire, hein, ce n'est même pas le rire du tout. En fait, le propre de l'homme, il n'y en a presque plus. Puisqu'on sait que les outils, par exemple, on pensait que c'était nous les premiers. On sait maintenant que c'est peut-être des grands singes qui ont fait les premiers des outils. Donc le propre de l'homme n'existe même plus. Mais s'il en avait un jamais de propre de l'homme, ce serait certainement de se déplacer. Nous sommes des homos mobilis depuis le début et nous le serons toujours. Que la sédentarité ait débouché sur les villes, les frontières, etc., il y a là une énorme aberration. Et ce que Emeka dit de la poétique des lieux, effectivement, devrait nous engager à plus de, on va dire, plus d'activisme pour qu'on récupère une souveraineté qui nous est propre, celle de l'article 13, conféré par la Charte des droits de l'homme, signée à San Francisco en décembre 45, le 10 décembre 48, et qui dit que tout être humain a le droit de changer de pays.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, this is our next road trip, beginning in August. And as you can see, there's the I am where I think, translated into four languages there. And of course, this expression is coming from, again, Walter Di Mignolo. It's a proposal, you know, a moving away from I think, therefore I am, of Descartes. And what he says about is, being where one thinks has become since then a fundamental concern of those who have been mapped out by the colonial and imperial differences, and therefore relegated to a second or third place in the global epistemic order. I am where I think set the stage for epistemic affirmations that have been disavowed. At the same time, it creates a shift in the geography of reason for the affirmation, I am where I think. So it's really moving away from that. You know, it's a geography of reason, so it's not about only about location, but it's shifting reason. But again, with the Invisible Borders road trip, we are trying to approach this by saying, as we travel through these places that has strong historical implications, and which is also a volatile negotiation between, you know, the past and present, we are thinking from that place, from, you know, that, you know, by with our body as an active thinking entity. So the knowledge we are producing is specific to the realities coming from there, and it does not need, you know, to seek validation elsewhere. It does not need to seek validation elsewhere. We are producing knowledge from that space, and something unique that is attached to the experience of being there, you know, with our body and our presence. So, yeah.
But when it comes to epistemic disobedience, je dois dire aussi quelque chose là, c'est que toujours Michel Serres, hein, parce que cette figure-là, même si elle est, on va dire, un peu connue, elle est mal connue. Ce monsieur parle justement d'exode à propos de la connaissance contre la méthode. Il dit « exodus ». Notre méthode. Et il envisage, il propose même d'ailleurs, il n'envisage pas que la connaissance soit un voyage, le même qu'ils font à travers l'encyclopédie des sciences et en traversant toutes les frontières qui existent et qui créent ce que Kuchia appelle le spécialisme. En l'occurrence, comment veut-on que le biologiste ou l'économiste aujourd'hui, pourquoi d'ailleurs l'économiste parle d'équilibre et demande aux États d'avoir des comptes équilibrés, de régler les déficits, de vendre la SNCF? C'est quoi l'équilibre du point de vue de la thermodynamique? C'est juste la mort, c'est-à-dire qu'il ne se passe plus rien, il n'y a plus de mouvement. Mais on nous a imposé depuis M. Adam Smith, depuis, je pense donc, je suis, dans la suite logique de ça, avec Newton au passage, on nous a imposé cette idée de l'équilibre, cette idée de la linéarité du temps, parce que c'est ça que l'économie nous dit. C'est ça que la comptabilité en partie double, débit, crédit, mouton, elle nous parle de linéarité. Ce paradigme-là, qui s'est répandu doucement, tranquillement, depuis à peu près 4 siècles ou 5 siècles, il est peut-être temps qu'on l'interroge effectivement. Et leur expérience de Invisible Borders, on peut tout à fait la décalquer du point de vue cognitif sur l'ensemble des sciences. C'est-à-dire que je peux être économiste, mais il n'y a pas de raison que je ne m'intéresse pas à la philosophie, à l'astrophysique, que je ne m'intéresse pas à la chimie. Il y a eu, il y a quelques jours, j'ai vu dans Le Monde un congrès sur l'asymétrie, organisé à Nice, sur l'asymétrie dans le monde du vivant. Et il se trouve que l'asymétrie n'existe pas simplement dans le monde du vivant. Dans l'astrophysique, le commencement de la matière n'aura été possible, nous n'existons que parce que il y a plusieurs milliards d'années, il y a eu une asymétrie dans les particules fondamentales. C'est elle qui a permis que la matière puisse exister. Autrement dit, l'asymétrie est véritablement le paradigme fondamental de notre existence en tant que des êtres pensants. Donc la linéarité, le spécialisme, être enfermé dans une discipline de point de vue unique, ça n'a absolument plus aucune pertinence. Il est temps d'être impertinent de ce point de vue.
Thank you. So, I just thought, okay, before I move on, let me just give a bit of context, an Invisible as a project. It was founded in 2009, and since then we, I'm finishing really soon. It's just two slides left. Since then we, it's basically a project that brings African artists together, photographers, writers, filmmakers, to engage this question of borders as it relates to the 54 countries in the continent. But since then it has evolved, to other, questions. And I've already pointed out that. So we've tried as much as possible to have road trips every year, but sometimes it's been like, one in 2 years. We have, basically we travel by road and we, as artists, just experience the road and, living and being in all these border conditions and creating works that are, precipitates of, everyday experiences. It's again this, thinking, active body in movement, basically. I'm about to end, and this is a poem that I wrote thinking about my daughter. But of course, it is written from a it was written from a place of moving around and being. You can see that I was on the move, thinking about moving, thinking about the question of moving around and then being able to come back to my daughter at every point in time that I leave, that I have to come back, and knowing that I can be stuck somewhere and that coming back will not happen, or that. So it's always the anxiety of moving around and having somewhere that you attach your love or
your heart.
Or your heart, yeah, let me put it that way. Of course, this affects, what you see as home, and even makes it more complex. But you carry that with you. So I have written many poems, to this effect. And where I'm going to with this is, again, this whole idea of the emotion, the logic of emotion. All this, but also I think what follows is the science of intuition, like like Mantia Diawara would say, you know, the science of intuition. All of this that, you know, that is oftentimes negated when we are thinking about art or the intellect. You know, I think that for me they are very, very real in the way I create, in the way I think about all this tension around borders and the violence. And finally, I come to this word, Ihunanya. It's one word, but it's actually a sentence. It means love in my language, the Igbo language, Ihunanya. But what it also means is to see in the eye. So in French, it would be regarder dans les yeux. And in English, it would be to regard, which is the opposite of disregard. Yeah? And oftentimes, I feel like we, you know, sometimes, you know, in our differences, we sometimes come to a place of beginning from a place of disregard. And the way I understand love is that you have to, you know, regard, you have to look in the eyes, you have to appreciate the humanity in a human being. You might not like the person. There is first of all the person before there is Lionel. There's a person as a human being, and then there's Lionel. You might not like Lionel, but you should not, or I think that you should try as much as possible to recognize the humanity he carries within him. And that if you affect that by your actions, that it means that you disregard, you don't respect. And why I say this is because I had an experience coming back to Paris 2 days ago on the bus. Two women were fighting each other. Like, it was a serious fight. I don't know what happened. But everybody was around 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the bus. And everybody was trying to calm them down. And this is a moving bus. So interesting. But they wouldn't stop. But at some point, the driver came. And he didn't ask questions. He immediately started roughhandling one of them. He took her, you know, folded her arms behind her. But then, by then, the bus had stopped. And then pulled her, and then pushed her out. If you know the Eurolines bus, you know there's a distance between there and there. And then she landed on the floor. And then I came up, you know, removing my headphones, saying, excuse me, you can't do that. There is no reason why you should do that. I mean, I don't even see any reason why. You are the one introducing violence here now. Because I know the both of them are fighting each other, but it is within their own misunderstanding. And they are different from us because we are trying to sleep. But they are also human beings doing their thing. And we are trying to see how we come into that story and see if we can mitigate things. And then you come with this whole violence that reeks of disregard for the human being, you know, and then you threw her out. So you don't do that. And of course, all the other human beings there started also, you know, was against him. And we said, it's very simple. If you think that they're breaking the law somehow by actually, you know, disturbing everybody here, the next stop you call the police. And then the police will come and decide if they need to be rough handled like this or not. You put on handcuffs and all that. Is the job of the police, but you, I don't understand where the violence is coming from. But thing is, eventually, a woman who spoke French, German, and English in the bus said, oh, you know what he was saying when he was coming? He was murmuring under his breath like, oh, that's how these black people behave. So, again, we come back to that disregard. Before he even got there, there was this disrespect for the human being, for the person. You don't even treat the person as a person. And I now understand where that all that violence is coming from. Because there was no need for that. There was really no need for that. You know, two people fighting, all you could do is just say, hey, stop fighting. But I think that there was already a prejudice that, you know, that has to do with race and blackness and whiteness and all of that. And the truth is that, I guess, he was the only one really overtly showing that kind of racism. Because everyone there were French there, everybody, like, there was a Moroccan there. Everybody came in to mitigate that situation. But it didn't happen. It didn't stop. Anyway, the story was that we got to the next stop. And then he called the police, and the police came, took these two people away in the middle of nowhere, 2 a.m., and then we continued the journey. But for me, I thought there was something that was missing in that. I thought that is this, first of all, this disregard for the humanity in a human being, you know, that I thought that was that was the case, and that was why he had that that way of treating that lady like she was trash. Even trash, you don't throw it that way. When you throw your trash, you throw it carefully so that it falls into somewhere. But the way he threw that lady, it was worse than a trash. So on that note, I end. Thank you very much for listening. Mm-hmm.